Welcome to the Belfast Men's Health Group podcast with myself, Paul O'Kane, and Paul Smith. Paul has a lifetime of experience in international youth work, primarily focused on conflicted and post-conflicted societies. His work with young people has taken him around the world. Today, Paul's going to talk a wee bit about the importance of engaging with young people and what can be achieved when young people have a voice. But before that, Paul, you're very welcome. And thanks very much for agreeing to do this wee podcast.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. So tell us a wee bit about yourself, Paul. How would you describe yourself? Any sort of influences, your background? There's a three-in-one question.
Well, I suppose what I'm doing now really came out of an experience when I was a young teen where I got involved with peace people. Mm-hmm. So where a lot of my peers were getting involved in the conflict, either through things like the police and the UDR or through paramilitary organizations. I was fortunate because I got involved with the peace movement and it really shaped my thinking and development as a person. Has given me incredible experiences in terms of working with people around the world. Mm-hmm. And very much shaped who I am today, I think.
Mm. Okay, and peace people, when did that start?
Makes me feel very old, doesn't it? 1976.
Right, and is it still going?
The organisation's still going. You'll probably remember that two of the women who founded the organisation, Mairead Corrigan and Betty Williams, got the Nobel Peace Prize. It's kind of interesting to talk to young people about this now because you ask them about who do you know from Northern Ireland that has a Nobel Peace Prize? If you're lucky, they'll say John Hume and David Trimble. Mm-hmm. But nobody seems to remember that actually two women got the prize before them. And I would argue that actually the Good Friday Agreement came about more because of the space that had been created by people like the peace movement, but also the trade unions, the women's sector, community sector. Mm-hmm. Than great political leadership. I think for me, the leaders realized that there was space that they could exploit, but they didn't create it. It was created by other people. So it was an incredible experience as a teenager. And then I volunteered for the peace people for a year after I finished school. And that year turned into 3 years. And I ended up working with them for a few years and I've been in various roles since then, but mostly shaped by my experience of community relations work and trying to build understanding between people from different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. So you said you've given us a wee bit about your youth and growing up. What about mentors or people to look up to, people who inspired you? Any of those that spring to mind or any memories that stick with you that you're happy to share?
Yeah, I suppose initially the peace people were a huge influence on me, particularly Ciarán McKeown, who was another of the co-founders. Ciarán was a former journalist, one of the smartest people I ever met. That sadly died a couple of years ago from cancer. And Mairead McGuire was the other, and they were so different. Mairead, very emotional, very kind of spiritual person. Ciarán, much more kind of logical and thoughtful. And he was kind of the intellect in many ways behind the peace people. And I had huge conversations with him about nonviolence when I was younger. And one of the best bits of advice I got was from him, which was to challenge everything. And it just kind of made me much more critical in my thought. I tend not to take anything at face value. And I always encourage young people to do this in my work, not to just kind of accept what people are saying as gospel, but to take ideas apart and make your own mind up about them. I think it's funny because I was actually thinking about this recently, and probably there are three significant figures that have had a big influence on my thinking. One was Ciarán, who was Catholic, and I'm from a Protestant background, though I'm not at all religious. And then another is a guy called Mike Bazerman. I don't know if you've ever met him, but he was a former professor of youth studies from the University of Minnesota. And he's actually Jewish. His family are Jewish. And the third was a guy called Zane Ibrahim. And Zane created an amazing radio station in Cape Town called Bush Radio.
Right.
You should actually listen to it. You can listen to it online. He was a fighter for the ANC. He was caught and tortured by the South African Defence Forces in Namibia. And then he lived in exile for a couple of decades in the Netherlands and in Canada.
Wow.
And his dad was the imam of the mosque in Cape Town. Zane wasn't religious either, but he had an incredible compassion for people. And he created Bush Radio. Their name comes from whenever they were founded, they were a resistance radio station. So it was before the peace agreement. And they literally ran it from the bush. They were running away from the South African defense forces with their transmitter and so on. But it's probably the best example of community radio I've heard anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly run by young people.
Right.
So in the year 2000, I went to South Africa for the first time. It was with a woman called Marie Smith, who had a project called the Cost of the Troubles Project. And there were various people on the trip with me. One was Tony Gallagher at Queen's, professor of education at Queen's, who's become a good friend since. But we visited Bush Radio on that visit, and I was interviewed by a 14-year-old girl in the radio studio. And as soon as she'd asked the second or third question, I'd completely forgotten her age because her questions were incredible, and I was really struggling to answer them. And there were all these wee kids outside the studio twiddling knobs and pushing levers and stuff and doing stuff that I didn't understand. It actually profoundly changed my view of youth work.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember coming out of the studio and thinking, why does youth work always look like youth work? And what I meant by that was, why do we play at life with young people instead of inviting them to do life?
Mm-hmm.
So you get all these projects where young people have a mock United Nations or a mock parliament or, you know, some of the kind of youth councils and other models, to me, are about play rather than real world ideas. And young people often don't have the opportunity to affect change because adults underestimate them and don't invite them to be part of the change. So it really kind of shifted my own thinking in terms of what I was doing. And I decided I wanted to put my energy into things that really make a difference and where young people feel that they are making a difference in the world.
And I suppose that's an audience that we're not getting to as young people, but hopefully through yourself, Paul, we can get there.
You never know.
Tell us a wee bit about what work you're working on now with young people. Or where you're at?
Yeah, so I've had various roles working in voluntary organisations, and worked for the Youth Council for Northern Ireland for a while. I also worked on a project at the University of Ulster and was actually freelance for a number of years. A lot of your listeners may use Nextdoor, the neighbourhood app.
Yep, we've
and
heard
actually
it.
Was the person who set it up here. So they hired me to get it going in Northern Ireland. That was a real learning curve for me because I hadn't worked in the tech sector before.
Okay.
But I've been working for the last year with Politics in Action, which is a tiny little organization. When I joined, I was literally the only member of staff. There's three of us now, and we have a little office on University Street. But we do political engagement work with young people, mostly in clusters of schools, so loosely based around the kind of shared education model. So be a mixture of Protestant and Catholic and secondary and grammar and integrated schools in a particular geography. And we run an after schools program where we invite young people to talk about issues they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And then develop a project or a campaign that relates to that particular issue. And then we bring them to meet politicians at the Assembly, sometimes at the Oireachtas in Dublin as well. They discuss their ideas with politicians.
And do you get any ideas that maybe these young people fancy politics themselves?
Some do, but mostly, I don't know how you feel about it, but I kind of feel like I'm a political animal, but I don't have a political home. There are none of the parties here that really do it for me.
Stop you laughing, Brian.
And I think that a lot of people feel like that, you know, that if you're not interested in tribalism, there aren't many places to feel comfortable. So what we find is young people realize that politics is actually about more than... A lot of young people equate politics with sectarianism. And so they say, I'm not interested in politics, meaning they don't want to be part of sectarianism. So we kind of help them to understand that politics is actually about everything that goes on in our society, and we do need to take an interest. And also, if you want to change things, you kind of need to understand how politics works. So I think more so it's about young people having that fire in their belly about, you know, if I'm annoyed about something, I can actually make a difference on it, and kind of helping to create that belief among young people that change is possible.
And do you find that some of the our sort of older concerns are similar to what young people's concerns are? And the one that springs to mind is global warming, or I think that's on everyone's agenda, but particularly surely young people.
Yeah, I mean, I think without wanting to get too political on your podcast, I'm kind of disgusted at the minute with UK politics and how it's dealing with issues around the environment. Rishi Sunak seems to be backpedaling at a ferocious rate in terms of their environmental commitments. But even with Starmer, I was at a conference in London a few weeks ago where he spoke, and his strap line was growth, growth, growth. And I kind of came away from it feeling that relentless growth on a burning planet is immoral. So I actually think our generation is not angry enough about this issue. Young people are, but they often don't know how to channel that anger. And I think we have a shared responsibility to do something about that. You know, even this summer we've seen the devastating impacts of global heating.
Without a doubt.
And our children and our grandchildren are going to experience that more and more. Party politics tends to be very short term in its thinking, particularly when there's election coming up. They just sort of sacrifice all kinds of principles to try and win the election. We need to hold our politicians to account. I always say to young people that politics is far too important to leave to politicians. You know, and because most of us do leave it to politicians, then they can get away with all of the things that they get away with. But I think a better democracy is what where civil society, where citizens hold politicians to account.
Right. Well, I think we'll have to leave that now. We'll jump into your travels.
I can imagine
now.
The head of the health service editing the hell.
I think we're all right. I think we're not too bad. So
you can't invite a guy from an organization called Politics in Action and not expect a bit of politics.
A wee bit of politics. So
but I think I had to go at everybody, to be fair.
You did. It's everybody got the boot stuck in there, so we're okay. We're all right. So you did talk about this question is about what have you learned from your travels, particularly to Israel and Palestine and beyond, and you have said about South Africa and Bush Radio. Any other sort of memories or that have stuck with you that you've carried?
Think that when you travel, you actually learn more about the place you come from than the place you're visiting, because it challenges you to think differently.
No, keep going.
There you go.
Keep going.
So I think particularly because my career has taken me to conflict regions and post-conflict societies quite a bit, then you start thinking more deeply about your own context. So particularly the first time I went to Israel and Palestine, I came home and I was just wrecked for days. I remember going into East Jerusalem, which is supposed to be the Palestinian part of Jerusalem, but it's increasingly being occupied by settlers and so on. And within the old city, you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which most people would recognize. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the Wailing Wall, which is one of the most holy sites in Judaism, is actually right at that spot. So the wall the wall essentially holds up the soil that the mosque is built on. And you really get a feeling of it being probably one of the most contested spaces on the planet. And then it's kind of weird because you travel around the old streets and you find these little stalls where people are selling stuff. And they're selling Israeli army caps beside Palestinian scarves. And you kind of realize that commerce kind of trumps conflict, that they'll sell whatever people want to buy. So it kind of brings you back down to earth again. But, you know, I think in many ways in Northern Ireland, we've been fortunate that our conflict has not been as bloody and destructive as a lot of other places in the world. I visited Bosnia just a couple of weeks after the war there finished in the 90s.
Yes.
And we actually drove up from Split in Croatia through to Mostar. And at that stage, the famous bridge in Mostar was gone because it had been bombed. And I met a young Irish soldier there. He was actually yelling at me because I was walking down a street I shouldn't have been walking down.
Right.
I hadn't cleared it from mines yet.
Right.
My wife doesn't know that story. I hope she doesn't listen to this podcast. And there was an enormous crater, and then they were building all around it. And I said, "What's this?" He says, "This is the new Catholic Basilica." And I said, "Well, what was there before?" He said, "Mosque." And, you know, when you travel around Ireland, you know that a lot of the ancient churches are built on sites that were religious or spiritual sites for the sort of pre-Christian communities that lived here. And it always seems a bit, it never seems like a, it just seems like a natural thing in some ways. But when you actually see it in the contemporary setting, it's really disgusting. You know, to wipe out someone else's holy site, build your own, is a pretty bad indictment of religion. So I think that, you know, I think it's really important that people travel, that they, and I don't mean going to beach resorts and drinking this and eating the same food that they eat at home. But, you know, to really try to understand other cultures and other people is a great way of unpacking your own biography and starting to understand yourself a little bit better. And I love doing international work with young people where you're maybe doing exchanges or taking them on a visit somewhere else because you can just see their minds going like the clappers, you know, just trying to make sense of everything. It's one of the worst outcomes of Brexit for me is that we've lost the what used to be called the Erasmus Youth Programme, which funded a lot of that stuff. So young people just don't have anything like the opportunities to do that they used to. I think particularly for Northern Ireland, it's actually very important that that happens because we need people to move out of their silos and think differently.
And I mean, I go back to 1986 whenever there was it was called Children's Committee 10, where a Protestant and Catholic would go to America for 6 weeks and experience something different. And you definitely do. And without a doubt, that shaped, well, had a part to play in shaping me.
Yeah.
So, travel and getting away and learning definitely does benefit you.
One of my favorite places that I visited that most people don't go to is Lebanon.
Okay.
So I did a number of pieces of work there. I think I've been 3 or 4 times to Lebanon over the years. It's an extraordinarily beautiful country. And one time I had to go to a town called Baalbek, which is in the middle of the Bekaa Valley, which is the big valley that runs basically the whole length of of Lebanon between two mountain ranges, and it's a very fertile valley, so a lot of the farms and vineyards and stuff were there.
Okay.
And I was staying in this sort of colonial hotel, sort of French Victorian building.
Right.
And it only had 5 or 6 guest rooms. And when I got there, the electricity was off, which is pretty common in Lebanon. It's even more common now, unfortunately. So I just went to bed. And they got up in the morning and I pulled back the curtains and I saw one of the most astounding views that I've seen in my life. So I was looking out across the Bekaa Valley and the mountains in the distance were covered in snow. It was just breathtaking. And to my left was the most ornate mosque that I've ever seen. It was just really beautiful. And I looked over to the right and there's this incredible suite of Roman temples that was built by Antony to declare his love for Cleopatra.
Okay.
And it was a massive complex, probably bigger than the Parthenon in Athens.
Wow.
And I wasn't meeting my colleagues until later in the day. So I went out and had a walk around these temples and there was about 6 or 7 other people there. If it had been anywhere in Europe, it would have been crawling with tourists. But Lebanon's really interesting because their civil war, they had a 15-way split.
Right.
So they have so many different factions and religious groups and political groups and so on. It's a really complex place. So it actually makes Northern Ireland seem very straightforward.
Yeah.
But I remember I brought a group of educators from Lebanon to Northern Ireland and the things that really shocked them were our segregated education system and the so-called peace walls. We just couldn't believe that we had walls separating communities. And it was really interesting, somebody who had their experience, because their civil war, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people died.
Yeah.
Even for them, it was kind of shocking how we organize our society and how we embed division even now.
It sounds very much a lovely place, and still I guess there's not many tourists going there.
No, there's another lovely town on the coast called Byblos, which is where the alphabet was invented.
Wow.
And it has so many layers of history in it, a lot of pre-Roman stuff and then Roman stuff, and again I was doing a tour there and very, very few tourists around. And Lebanon now is a complete mess. It's in a pretty disastrous situation and it has very corrupt politics. So there are kind of small number of families who are kind of feudal lords and who suck the life out of the country. And it's such a shame because it really is a very beautiful part of the world, and the people are actually very compassionate and understanding toward each other by and large. So it should be the most wonderful and peaceful part of the Middle East, but it's kind of teetering on the edge again. And I suppose like most countries in the Middle East, they're prey to what's going on around them.
Yeah.
To kind of more global politics. And we're lucky in Northern Ireland that that's not an issue for us. You know, nobody has an interest in keeping the conflict going. So there's a lot of goodwill here. And often actually I remember when Bill Clinton was here at the time of the Good Friday Agreement and he talked about Northern Ireland as a beacon of hope for the rest of the world. And that always stuck with me because I kind of feel that we've screwed up, that there isn't anywhere on the world that has so much going for it, that has had a long period of conflict, and we've accomplished relatively little. The Assembly has only been up and running for...
That's a karaoke.
For less than 60%.
In and out, or not, no, it's karaoke. What is it? It's not a karaoke. What's the word?
Carousel.
In and out, the hokey cokey. You're in, you're out.
I think that's a shame because a lot of people in the world look to us.
Yeah.
And... in a sense, if you can't make this place the most vibrant post-conflict society, what hope is there for other places in the world? So I was part of the, my organization was part of the events to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement recently at Queen's. We brought 230 young people together and they met some of the kind of key players in the peace process. It was an amazing experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of came away from it feeling like there's a whole new generation of stuff that we need to be doing.
Yeah.
And we really cannot leave this to the politicians because in many ways they're stuck in their own models.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't seem very invested in making politics work here. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to find ways of making sure that they do the job that we elect them to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what advice then would you give to young people, I guess, to be the best, Paul, being their best?
Well, the focus of your podcast is on health, and I think that's really important. I know that the Mental Health Champion recently suggested that 52% of young people here have poor mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very shocked at that figure. I knew it was high, but I didn't expect it to be that high. And I think I read a little bit a while ago because I was doing some work for Friends of the Earth about climate anxiety.
Mm.
And when I was reading it, I was thinking, climate anxiety is pretty logical. It's not irrational.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is if you have anxiety about things like that and you don't know how to do anything to make things better,
mm-hmm.
Then that can turn into a mental health problem. So young people have anxiety about lots of things. There's a generation of young people who have just been through the most extraordinary restrictions on their lives. I don't think there's ever been a period like it where mm-hmm. young people's lives were so curtailed because of the COVID pandemic.
Yep, yep.
And we are only beginning to understand the impact that that has had on them. I know, for example, that school truancy has gone through the roof.
Okay.
A lot of young people are very anxious about mm-hmm. going back to school. So I think that it's really important that people look after their own mental health and each other's, and that they find ways of supporting each other. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to join something, is mm-hmm. to be part of a group.
Yep.
And to have a sense of shared purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of the young people who work with it tell us that they really love the programs that we run, particularly when they can do residentials and stuff like that. That it really kind of helps deal with feelings of isolation, helps them realize that other people are struggling with a lot of the things that they're struggling with. But as another issue I'm very vexed about is the levels of misogyny among young men.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of been looking into this over the last few years and been very shocked by it. They kind of, I know now they talk about Andrew Tate and his kind of influence on, mm-hmm. on young men, but actually for decades, people have been preying on young men online and, you know, feeding their sense of hurt. So young men who've maybe been unsuccessful in relationships, you know, this incel, involuntary celibate label that right. a lot of young men are adopting. But it's being fed by very dangerous elements, mostly far-right elements online.
Mm-hmm.
Young women are feeling the consequences of that. And I think that this has all been happening below the radar and adults and education systems haven't really geared themselves up to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to have to deal with it. You know, I kind of thought that those kind of very sexist ideas were sort of the generation before me.
Yeah.
So it's really very shocking when you hear a young man coming out with stuff that I would associate with a much older generation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we've talked about mental health. How do you look after yourself, Paul?
That's a good question. Yeah, during lockdown, just before lockdown, I'm not normally a very lucky person, but I bought a bicycle just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I've cycled most of my life, but I'd actually had a bike stolen out of my garage and just didn't get a new one.
Yeah,
So I bought one in December and then the pandemic hit in January. And I called it my sanity cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take it out and go the distance I was allowed to go in a loop. And just to kind of get out of the house, I found it really difficult. And I'd worked from home since 2016, so everybody else thought it was a great novelty working from home. I was kind of bored with it, so I needed to get out. I swim a couple of times a week and cycle, and usually do a longer cycle at the weekend, and that really helps. But again, I think being with other people and working with people and working on things together is great. I've been very lucky. You know, a lot of people are in jobs that they hate, that are a bit of a drudge. And I've always managed to be involved in things that really motivate me and that I enjoy.
You must have seen my questions, Paul, because you've already sort of, you're starting to answer the next one, which is a dream job. Now, I suppose you're allowed to be in your dream job, but I mean, if I give you £1 million, what would you do? Or what would you like to do?
One thing I would like to do that I don't have the time to do, or maybe I just don't have the motivation, is to paint again. So I studied fine art
at
college. My first degree was in fine art, and I really enjoyed doing that degree and having the time. Just, it actually felt quite guilty initially that I could just do art all day, every day. So there's part of me that kind of wants to get back to that, although I think I kind of satisfy my creative side quite a bit in the work that I do. So I've done like media work with young people. Actually, I'm envying your mics because I'm just about to do a podcast series with a group of young people. So we're buying similar equipment.
Very good.
Yeah, well, they're going to produce it, not me, but I'm just going to help them. You know, honestly, it probably sounds a bit naff, but I'm not sure that I would want to do anything other than what I'm doing. I probably, you know, if I had the resources, I might travel a bit more, or I might buy somebody in to do some of the things I don't enjoy so much, like admin and what have you. I feel really privileged. Yesterday, I put a story up on our website about a young woman called Lucy who's won a scholarship to go to a school called Lawrenceville, which is in New Jersey. And it's part of a program called Protégés for Peace. So this Irish-American woman contacted me because they were looking for young people to go to this school. Now, the school, it looks like Harvard, the campus. It's just
lovely.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
But for many years, they've brought two young people, Protestant and Catholic, every year on a scholarship there. So one of this young woman's from Portadown College, and she's just arrived now in New Jersey. And I know she's going to have an extraordinary year, and it'll probably shape much of what she does in the rest of her life. And it's a real privilege to sort of watch young people grow in front of you and to give them opportunities that stretch them. And often, you know, the young people are given opportunities and they think, I don't know if, you know, it's the imposter syndrome thing. I don't know if I'm good enough for this or if I get. And when they sort of live up to their promise, it's just amazing to watch. So I don't know that anything else can replace that kind of feeling.
So and again, you've nearly answered the next question. Happiness. That gives you delight. What else?
I love walking and just sort of getting out and about. We have a wee dog that we adopted during lockdown. My daughter's fought with my wife for 20 years to get her to agree, and now she'd be absolutely devastated if anything happened to the dog. And he's just a joy. So again, I suppose
they work their way into the family.
It's connections with other people. I love music. My wife could probably live without music, which is extraordinary to me. So I probably don't listen to enough live music. But I love music and culture. And I think those are the things that make me happy, as well as just seeing my own daughters grow and succeed and accomplish things.
Very good. Well, I think that's our podcast concluded, apart from the last question, which is, have you any ideas for the next podcast, or who could we get that would be maybe willing to take part.
I don't know if you've heard of a group called Pure Mental.
I haven't.
Okay, so Pure Mental is a group that was created by young people to sort of put pressure on the assembly in terms of young people's mental health. So they've been really effectively campaigning, and they've managed to get some stuff onto the school curriculum and so on. But it's a young person-led organization, so I strongly recommend you chat to them. There's also a group that I've done a little bit of work with called Diverse Youth NI, and they are young people whose families are mostly from the African continent. They're a mixture of second generation young people, but also refugee and asylum seeker families. And they've been running their own mental health campaign. I can't remember the name of it, but it was really interesting listening to them talking about it, because they said they're coming from cultures where there's no recognition of the concept of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you can't really talk about it.
Yeah.
And because particularly if you're a male, it's seen as a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been trying to get the authorities here to understand that you can't adopt a one-size-fits-all approach to mental illness with young people, and you need to actually understand the cultural context that people are coming from. And I find that very powerful. So both those groups would be well worth talking to, I think.
We'll certainly look into it. And I think it only leaves me to say, Paul, thanks very much for coming in. It's been great to have you here.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Cheers.